Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we speak with Brian Stokes Mitchell about his CD and concerts and other things that he's done in and around Broadway. We also review Scandalous that opened up at the Neil Simon Theater, Giant at the Public, and we talk about A Christmas Story at the LaFontaine again. So please stay with us and listen.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd bitty bitty bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Diddle 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 dum. If I were a bitty bitty rich, digga digga diddle diddle man.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Monday, November 26, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the call this evening, we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portanti, and Jan Simpson. Peter is a writer who can be found at Master Broadway on Tuesdays, at Critchland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You could see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could also see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Michael also writes for outlets such as the Sondheim Review. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
Also with us is Jan Simpson. Jan is a writer who you can find at Broadway and Me. She is also the co-director of the Arts and Culture Journalism Program at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism and a writer for TDF Stages. Good evening, Jan.
Hi.
With us this evening, we have a special guest, Brian Stokes Mitchell, who is a Broadway performer who we've seen in so many different things. From his career includes Man of La Mancha, Kiss Me Kate, Ragtime, August Wilson's King Hedley II, Kiss of the Spider Woman, Jelly's Last Jam, David Merrick's OK and Mail, for which he earned a Theater World Award for Outstanding Broadway Debut, and perhaps Peter would know something about that. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about Brian in his Theater World debut?
I can take no credit for that whatsoever. Yes, I saw the show, but I was not a voter then with the Theater World, but I'll never forget John Willis, who was running the organization then, saying to me two nights after he saw Mail, we were at an off-Broadway sty, and he said to me, you know, I saw the most exciting guy the other night. I mean, he didn't have a big part, he didn't have a lot to do, but I'm telling you, this guy's going to be a star. And it was just one of the many predictions that John Willis made that turned out to bear fruit. So, yeah, I remember Mail. I remember what it looked like. And I remember Michael Rupert up there coming home after a long time and not having enough and having so much mail that had built up. You know, those were in the days before email. And he didn't have anybody collecting his mail. And Mr. Mitchell, tell us, what did you have to do with those letters? Do you remember?
Well, I played the best friend, Michael Rupert's best friend. They were, you know, it was this kind of crazy show where people would appear, he would open his letters. This was before texting and everything, of course, sure. And people had answering machines with tape. And he just runs out of town without telling anybody. And then his answering machine breaks down, and all he has are letters from his friends, and as he opens them up, all these different people in his life, his agent, his friend, his girlfriend, and the letters come to life, and I was his best friend, and so I was one of the people that came to life a few times. That was nice to hear that John said that. I don't know if you've told me that before, or if I ever really knew that, but
no, that's really true.
That's kind of cool.
So, Brian, you
call
just
me Stokes. That's what my friends call me.
I'm so
if you
sorry.
Want, if you want to be my friend, call me Stokes.
So, Stokes, the your new CD is out, and
yes.
I want you to tell us about what was the process like for developing that, picking the songs, and how you presented it. Peter, we talked about Stocking Stuffers last week, and Peter mentioned your CD, and I says, oh, we got to get Stokes on the podcast, and so
yeah.
Tell us.
What's wonderful about it is that he becomes the characters, don't you, sir?
Yeah, well, thanks, Peter, and thanks for spreading the word around it, about it. I couldn't figure out exactly what I wanted to do for my next album. One of the things that I knew I wanted to do definitely was to make it a very Broadway album. My first solo album was kind of an expression of who I am, and I used Broadway tunes to express that, but because my roots are really in jazz and world music and a lot of other forms of music and not just Broadway, a lot of that was in those songs on that original album. But this particular album is pure straight Broadway. There are 12 classic Broadway tunes, and that's, I knew I wanted to do a Broadway album. I have actually two other albums already in the can, but they're more jazz albums, and I didn't want to release them. I wanted to release the Broadway album first. One of my favorite albums of all time is a great album. They actually did two albums, Bill Evans and Tony Bennett. The two of them did an album of standards, and it's just the two of them, piano and vocalist only. And what I love about that recording is the purity of the music and the purity of the musicians as well. You really hear the incredible artistry of those two musicians, but also you hear the beauty of the songs when you're not distracted by a trumpet fanfare and a timpani roll and all of the colors of the orchestra. You just hear the lyrics and you just hear the song, and I thought, hey, why don't I do this with a Broadway album and just piano and vocal? I'm not going to introduce another instrument anywhere throughout. My wife, of course, said, okay, well, what you have to watch out for, though, is it doesn't sound like an audition. And so Ted Firth and I, my pianist of 7 years now, got together, and we just started riffing on these great Broadway tunes, and we rearranged many of them, but you wouldn't know it. I wanted to keep everything in the spirit of the original tunes, and we sat in the studio, and we actually recorded everything at the same time, in the same room, in the same space, just like Tony Bennett and Bill Evans did, actually. It's a very retro way to record, but it's difficult because you can't change anything or overdub anything because the mics bleed into each other. So it was this wonderful, pure kind of recording, and we're riffing off of each other there in the session because we're both rather improvisational the way that we play, and it worked really, really well. I'm so happy with it, and it gave me the chance to kind of play all of these characters. Like you said, Peter, I got to become the different characters as well.
Was it difficult
go ahead, Janice, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Was it difficult to choose the songs you were going to do?
Yes, what was difficult was that there's so many songs. I actually recorded 24 songs for the album, and I had another three that I wanted to record, but I just ran out of time. And then I thought, okay, now I've got too many songs. Should I do a double album? How should I do this? And as I was looking at the songs, I realized a number of them were classic Broadway songs. Some of the other ones were a little bit more obscure or a little newer tunes. But the ones that really stuck out for me were, songs from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. It's about 50 years that it covers. And that kind of made it easy. And also, I wanted them to be well-known Broadway songs as well. And probably the most obscure one is Feeling Good. And most people that know and love Broadway know that tune, though. But some other people don't realize it's a Broadway tune. They've heard Nina Simone do it and a number of other artists cover it.
I thought that was a great way to start the album.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, really nice.
You certainly showed that you are feeling good. There's no question about it. Of course, if you didn't do the soliloquy from Carousel, you could have included two or three more songs,
That's true. Between that and If I Were a Rich Man, that's about 15 minutes on the album, I think.
You're so restricted by the limit of an 80-minute CD, but you could offer all the tracks as just downloadables.
Yeah, I was thinking of doing that, but I thought, you know what, I've got two albums worth, and what I may do is come out kind of with the second part of this album, and I'm not sure if I'll do that sooner or later. I may do it around Tony time, or I may wait till next Christmas. It kind of all depends, but the other songs are great songs as well, and they're really fun, and it just comes down to sitting down and editing it. Because I produced the album, I also edited it on Pro Tools as well, and that... some of those songs, we had 30 takes of them, just because we got wildly creative sometimes. And it was really fun, but it made it really hard to edit it because, as I said, I couldn't just, if I messed up a word, I had to literally take the whole phrase and the piano out, and sometimes he was playing something different so it wouldn't match. So I really tried to preserve an entire take from start to finish whenever I could.
Hmm.
Whenever I hear If I Were a Rich Man, I always judge it by the value of the animal sounds that's made in the middle. And you really did a great job there. So
thank you.
Good animal.
Thank you. It's on my special skills on my resume. Thank you.
What were some of the other songs? Can you give us a little sneak preview of what some of the other songs were?
In Praise of Women from A Little Night Music. Reviewing the Situation from Oliver. What were some of the other albums, songs? Guido's Song from Nine. I had so many. Now I can't think of them.
You've done very well to list three, for that matter. No, that
yeah, nice. But yeah, as you can tell, they're not the, you know, they're songs that Broadway aficionados love and appreciate. But I wanted this to be a real kind of meat and potatoes album, also for people that just wanted to hear, you know, classic Broadway tunes.
We haven't said the name of the album yet.
Have a little bit extra in How to Handle a Woman, because you do the verse that we don't get on the original cast album. So that's a little extra meat and potatoes. So thank you for doing that.
You're welcome. That was a lot of fun, actually.
Jan brought up a good point. We haven't said the name of the album is simply Broadway.
Yeah. So,
yes. Thank you, Jan. I appreciate that.
Which also lends it to having Simply Broadway 2 next year.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because the title was one of the first things that I came up with when I first thought of the concept of the album. It was about 2 years ago when I thought of it. And the title kind of popped into my head almost immediately. And the first thing I did was to get on the internet and thought, oh, this title's too good and it's too simple and it's too, you know, on the nose. There's got to be 50 albums called Simply Broadway. And there weren't. And I was really surprised. And it's the perfect, I think, title for the album.
But I was wondering if you were inspired by Barbra Streisand.
You know what? Yes, it would be the answer. But that's not where I got the title from. But man, is she a great singer or what? What I love about her is she has the ability to become different characters when she sings them and to really embody a song. And she's one of those. She's one of my favorite vocalists, as a matter of fact, for that reason.
Stokes, in support of this album, you've been doing concerts, and so tell us a little bit about your concerts.
Oh, well, I usually do concerts all over the United States, and that's what I've been doing, but I'm doing, with this album, I'm doing five special concerts, and what I wanted to do was do some charitable concerts. For one reason, I wanted to kind of inspire people to give whatever talents that they have to their town, their neighborhood, their state, wherever it is that they live. Everybody has something wonderful to offer. You know, a lawyer can do pro bono work. A bricklayer can help build a house. Everybody's got some special talent that they have. One of the things that I do is sing. So I decided to give a series of concerts. Half of the proceeds from the concerts will go to the Actors Fund, and the other half is going to a nonprofit theater. I did the first concert. It was set for October 31st, but Hurricane Sandy kind of had different ideas at Lincoln Center, and then we decided to move that concert. We moved it a week later, and then we got the nor'easter that day, so it snowed. But we still had a fantastic audience there. So that was kind of the first of the concerts, and I'm going to do these concerts all over the United States, and right now I'm putting together which theaters are going to get them. It all depends on schedule, size of theater, and a whole lot of other things that we're working with. But we've been talking to some really, really great places.
So I'm looking at your schedule on brianstokes.com, and you're just back from Louisville, Kentucky, and University of Iowa. You've been out in Las Vegas and in Cleveland and Seattle, and so you're really doing a lot of frequent flyer miles there.
Yeah, exactly. I was just in San Diego for Christmas with my dad, who's 92 years old now. So we can try to get out there. Did I say Christmas?
Yes, you did.
I meant Thanksgiving. Time flies, right? But we're out there for Thanksgiving with him, and then we're going to have Christmas with my relatives in Wisconsin. So I'm always traveling around. I do fly quite a bit.
You have coming up in 2013. You, it looks like Alabama, California, Arizona, D.C. You're at the Kennedy Center in May.
Yes.
And you have a benefit with Laura Benanti and Stony Brook at the Stoller Center for the Arts.
Yes. So yeah, that's just a few things, because what's on that schedule are the things that are definite right now. I have a whole lot of other ones that are cooking too. So, you know, if people keep their eyes on brianstokes.com, it keeps it's pretty current on what's available.
So you had mentioned that one of the concerts was in benefit of the Actors Fund, which you are the chairman, aren't you?
Yes. I've been the chairman of the board for about 10 years.
And how do you find the time to do all these things?
Well, there's an incredible staff over there, headed by Joe Benincasa, who's been the president of the fund for quite a few years now. It's the most incredible charity, and I feel incredibly fortunate because I have made my living as an actor right out of high school, literally. From the time I was 17 years old, I've worked solely as a performer. I've never had to do anything else, never had to wait tables. I never pumped gas. I've always made my living doing voiceovers, doing stage acting, acting in movies and television. And as a result, I call myself the luckiest actor in the world. So when I was asked by the Actors Fund, first to be a member of the board about 16 years ago, and then later to, if I would consider being chairman of the board, you know, when the universe has been so good to you, I think it's good karma to give back when you have the opportunity to do that. And Joe Benincasa and the staff there and the incredible board of trustees we have there, I mean, everybody really pulls their weight, and it's such an incredible charity. It's rated 4 stars on Charity Navigator, which I'm very proud of, as we all are there. I don't know if you know that, but it's a great a website that, for those that haven't heard of it, that that rates all of the charities. And the Actors Fund gets the highest of all the ratings, which is 4 stars, and we have consistently over the years, and mainly because 87 cents of every dollar that's sent in goes to the programs of the fund, which is, of course, not just for actors. It's for singers, dancers, actors, musicians, crew members, circus performers, anybody who's made their living in the performing arts in the theater.
That's an incredibly high rate. That's congratulations. That's really terrific.
Thank you. Yeah, there's not too many. I was very surprised. There's only a handful of charities actually on Charity Navigator that actually are 4-star rated, and we're one of them.
So your gala at Stony Brook at the Stoller Center with Laura, I mean, I sort of feel like you can go through all the Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown cast and book your whole year.
You sure could.
Or make a Frank Sinatra duets type of album.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we're going to have a blast. I can't wait to do that concert with her. I think we're going to have so much fun. I think she's an immensely talented and funny and fun to be with. And I'm just, I can't wait to do that show.
So, Michael, you had a question about mail that you wanted to talk about?
Oh, no, just that I saw it too, and I just dug out my my playbill.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and I had not looked at this playbill since I saw the show in 1988. Is that right?
88? Yeah, I believe so. And did you were noticing who else was in the show?
Well, yes. Robert Mandan. And,
yes. And Soap.
And Michelle Paik, just in a, you know, tiny little role.
Yes.
Mary Bond Davis.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, quite a group you had there.
and somebody who left before we opened on Broadway was a gentleman named Brad Wong, later known as B.D. Wong, because he left. He was also doing an ensemble role in it and left because he had been cast in M. Butterfly at the time. And that, of course, was the beginning of his great career as well. And he's actually one of my fellow trustees on the Actors Fund board.
All right, so when it closed after a month, did you say, like so many actors do, that's it, I'll never work again, it's over?
No, you know what? No, you never know. But I kind of felt, what really made it for me, actually, I think what did it was the Theater World Award. And I have to say, I was ignorant of it when I received it at first. My agent called me and said, you just got the Theater World Award. And I was ready to get on the plane and go back to Los Angeles, where I was living at the time. And I said to my agent, is that a good thing? I said, what's the Theater World Award? He said, oh, that's a very good thing. And he told me about it. And I remember going to it, and Jane Alexander presented my Theater World Award, but she had no idea who I was. She hadn't seen the show, but she was very, very gracious. And I realized what a great award that is to be given and to be in the company of the other people that have received it. And I have to say, to this day, it is my favorite of all the awards, I think, that I've ever received. It's incredibly pure. And thanks to John Willis, I mean, it was a labor of love of his. And it inspired me. It was like, okay, your show didn't run, but you know what? Here's a little something to kind of encourage you maybe to come back and give it a try again. And I think that certainly helped with that.
You mentioned that you were ready to get on a plane to go back to Los Angeles. I noticed on IMDb that you have extensive film and television credits here. So you're living, are you still living a dual coast life? I mean, these credits are all up to... I think yesterday you were on Glee, you know?
Yeah. You know, my motto is go where you're wanted. And I started out in the theater, actually, in San Diego, and then I moved to Los Angeles doing theater, and then I ended up getting into film and television. And in a very short amount of time, I got on a show called Trapper John M.D., which ran, this is why I call myself the luckiest actor in the world. It was the first series I ever auditioned for, and not only did I get the role, but it got picked up, and then it ran for 7 years, which is like nearly a statistical impossibility. Then after that, I knew I wanted to get back into the theater, and I knew I wanted to go on Broadway, since that's where my roots were. And after taking a detour into voiceovers and animation for quite some time, I ended up getting mail, and that started at the Pasadena Playhouse, and then ended up getting transferred to the Kennedy Center, and then which is I consider now my second home, practically. And then to Broadway. So, and then I go back and forth. As things call, I go out and do them. So I've learned not to say no, and not to just say, no, I'm just a theater actor now, or no, I'm just a television actor, to kind of embrace all of it.
So I read here that you were in the San Diego Junior Theater production of Godspell in 1974 at the Old Globe.
Yeah, that was actually, San Diego Junior Theater was started by the Old Globe Theater, but it was a separate kind of thing. That was done actually at the Old Globe when we did that. But before that, I started at San Diego Junior Theater with Casey Nicolaw and a whole bunch of other people. Raquel Welch started out there, and Christian Hoff was also, Christian and Casey were there when I was there at the same time. So it was kind of a wonderful place to learn my craft.
And you went to high school with Annette Bening?
I did, yes. She was a junior, I was a senior, and we were studied under a lady there. And now Annette also was on the board of trustees of the Actors Fund. It's kind of funny, you know, how these circles and things get completed and everything, you know, what goes around comes around, as the saying goes.
I was going to ask you about working with David Merrick on OK, but I couldn't.
Oh, man, I got a million stories.
maybe one or two.
Oh, my goodness. Where to start? Oh, that's a whole new radio show, actually. We could do, David Merrick, let's see. I'll tell one of the great stories about him. I mean, they were, you know, the stories, of course, run the gamut, as you would expect from David Merrick. But one of the amazing things about him is this was after he had had his stroke, and he didn't speak very well. He could get maybe one good sentence out, and then it would be, and you couldn't understand. Tamara Tooney, who's now on everything on television, she's Miss Television, she played my fiance in OK. And we were doing a scene one day, and this was just a few days before we opened, and we hear from the audience, and we continue to do this scene, and we're looking at each other's eyes, and we're saying the lines, but what we're saying in each other's eyes is, should we stop? Is that about us? What should we do? Meanwhile, we're saying the lines and doing everything, but there's this whole other conversation going on between us. And finally, we agreed, okay, let's just keep going. Okay, yeah, sure, that's great. So we kept doing the scene, and finally we got off stage, and we asked a lady named Natalie, his assistant, said, "What did he not like the scene? What was that about?" And she said, "No, he got very upset because he saw that there were some wrinkles on the teaser, you know, one of the curtains that are on the stage in a very subtle place. He could see everything. And what he did, if he saw anything that was wrong on the stage, he would call all of the department heads down, and he sat in the audience in this chair that was brought in specially for him. And he sat on the house right aisle, and he called all of the department heads down, and as each one came down, he would chew them out. Go! And then he'd motion them away, and the next person would come up. And that was his way. So that was what was going on during that.
Oh my goodness gracious.
But I got a million stories. One of these days I'll write a book about that.
You should. You should.
We'll look forward to it.
All right. Well, you're a Halloween baby, but we have to let you go back to your family life. It is a Monday night, and you do have family time. But we really appreciate you taking some time to spend with us tonight and tell us about your CD and concerts. And
thanks for having me. I so appreciate it. If anybody hasn't heard it, you can get it on Amazon.com or iTunes as well. Mm-hmm. Or you can go on Brian Stokes, and that'll point you to the right direction. But it's easy to get, and I've been getting such nice notices and reviews for it. I'm so happy. It turned out exactly the way I wanted to when I first conceived it. So, and everybody seems to really be appreciating it, and I'm grateful for all the fans and everybody that have written in and ordered it so far.
Great. Well, Nick, when you put out the second version, you'll come back and talk with us again, okay?
Love to.
All right, Brian. Stokes, excuse me.
Stokes.
Yeah, see now? You want to be my friend? Or what? I think you don't want to be my friend. I'm starting to get a little upset here.
Good night, sir.
Victim of a teleprompter. I only read what's in front of me, you know? Stokes, you have a great evening, and we'll speak with you soon.
I'd like to tell a story about Brian Stokes Mitchell, which says a lot about him. Back in 2001, when he was doing King Headley II, I walked by the theater one Saturday morning, and I saw the sign up saying, at this performance, the role usually played by Brian Stokes Mitchell will be played by, and I thought, uh-oh. On Monday, we're doing the Theater World Awards, and he's agreed to present. I hope he's going to be all right. Well, all right, he probably took off the matinee because he's going to do the evening performance. So I purposely went by that evening, and I'm sorry to say the sign was still up. Okay, maybe he'll be back tomorrow. I went back the next day, Sunday matinee. The sign was still up, and I was really worried. And also, during the same weekend, Dorothy Loudon called with a terrible emergency. She was going to present, but she couldn't either. So now I'm scrambling around to get people to substitute as presenters. And so wouldn't you know, Monday morning, he calls me with a croaky voice and says, listen, I'm sorry, I'm on vocal rest. I can't do it. And I said, no, please, you cannot do this to me. People have canceled. It's already, I mean, I've got to have you. You are a star. You are one of the few people we have that really everybody in that room will know, and you just have to do this for me. He says, you know, but the doctor told me not. I said, I know the doctor. Listen, I'm telling you this. If you do this for me today, I swear to you, I will never again bother you as long as I live for these Theater World Awards. And he said, okay, I'm going to come. And he came, even though he was on vocal rest, and he croaked out his little speech saying how much he loved the award, just as he did just now, so on and so forth. And to show what a good man of my word I've been, I've asked him twice since, and he showed up both times still, you know. So, I mean, he's really so good. He's such a nice guy, you know. I mean, I break my promises, but he certainly doesn't break his. So a fine human being as well as a great performer.
We're so blessed to have such
you bet.
Such wonderful, talented people that are extraordinarily nice. It's so rare that you hear that, and they do happen, the terrible stories of terrible people.
Oh, sure.
But it seems like Hollywood's got a lot more of them than Broadway does, you know?
Let's hope so.
All right, so let's move on here to talk about a few things. Our interview with Stokes went a little bit long, but we did promise that we were going to talk about Scandalous, which opened November 15th at the Neil Simon Theater. And so who wants to jump in here first? Peter, Michael, what do you think?
I'll do it. Scandalous is about Amy Semple McPherson, who's a fascinating character. I'll never forget in 1970 when the book Storming Heaven came out, a biography of her, and I read it with such interest. Also, if you can get a hold of this book, please do, because the pictures in it are hilarious. You'll swear that you're reading Little Me, because the pictures really look like they're staged and phony. They're not. So Amy Semple McPherson was really this holy roller religious person who started a church that has done a lot of good for people. And but was she pure as the driven snow? Apparently not. And Kathy Lee Gifford's book, Lyrics and Sometimes Music, along with two collaborators on the score, has come up with a musical about her, and I wish it were more interesting. She does try to go into a soup to nuts rendition. She does leave out a good deal about the mother, who turned out to be really quite a feisty character too, who had this, who was really what we call today a cougar. I mean, she had a very famous relationship with a guy she referred to as "What a Man." That's what she called him. And he was known in the, you know, a mini and what a man was seen at the Brown Derby last night. Really, the people always refer to him in that way until he beat her up. There's a picture of her in the book, in fact, with a thoroughly bandaged face, you know, with a small, brave smile. And she said to the press, "What a man turned out to be, what a flop." All right. Well, none of this turns up in the musical, and it is about Amy. And it's just so perfunctory. It's very paint by numbers. And we never get a point of view of whether how legit Amy is. Is she really somebody who is feels that she's genuinely called by God? Or is this a business? I don't know. So that's a problem. I'm going to file a minority report here about Carolee Carmello, who a lot of people say is really magnificent and maybe will win the Tony Award this time. And Lord knows, she's a wonderful performer. You can only be as good as your material. And the material is one night note, and so is she, I'm sorry to say. I don't think she's amazing. I think she does what she can. So that's a bit of a problem. What fascinates me, though, is the fact that the Four Square Gospel Church is a backer of the show. Now, you might say, well, yeah, they want to get her name out there. But one of the things that happens in the show is there's a trial. Amy is put on trial because she claimed she was kidnapped and a couple of people died trying to find her. And so the city of Los Angeles really wanted to prosecute her for wasting their time and money. And it's made very clear in the show that she got off because of bribery and blackmail. And one would think that the church that represents this lady would not want that out there, that they would demand that that be taken out. So that's a little curious. A friend of mine was coming in from Toronto a couple of weeks ago, and we met for lunch on Tuesday, and he said, you know, I had a ticket for Scandalous on Sunday, and I just couldn't go, and I was thinking of calling you up, but I figured, oh, you're going to something. And I was furious because I thought, oh, no, I was free on Sunday, and I could have gone. And now I'm thanking the Lord that I didn't go on that Sunday, because I would have never been able to go again. I mean, once is plenty for this show, and I don't think it'll be with us very long.
All right, Michael. What did you think?
Well, the first thing I noticed when I took my seat was that the playbill had not one but two inserts, one of the cast list and one of the musical numbers, which to me just, you know, spoke to how much the show had changed even up to right before the opening. And I don't know, you know, I mean, I certainly don't know what all of the changes were. I've heard some things. I believe I heard that George Hearn had a number towards the end, you know, in one of his two roles as the Reverend that was cut. But I don't know. But I mean, it's never a good sign when you see. And usually, to me, you know, usually you see one or the other, the musical numbers, you know. I was surprised to see the cast list be an insert. I'm not sure what exactly was involved with that. But here's another thing. I'm gonna admit it. I didn't realize George Hearn also plays Amy's father in the first part of the show, and I did not realize it was him until afterwards, because I just didn't know. I had heard he played the other role, and I somehow hadn't heard that he played the father. And it's funny because I thought to myself, you know, this guy is wonderful. He's such a good actor. I wonder who that is. And I meant to look him up at that time, and I just didn't. I didn't because the lights went down or whatever. But then somebody else told me, and I could not believe it at first. So I will give him props for that. He it was an amazing transformation, first of all. And, you know, he's such a wonderful actor that he did a great job. I also thought, Peter, I'm with you. I thought that Carol Lee seemed really kind of not into the character in many ways. She seemed kind of like was just reciting the lines. The singing was pretty magnificent, but and of course, you know, a lot of it can be attributed to the material. But I did still have that impression. I didn't feel she was able to rise above it as many people seem to be saying. But here's an interesting thing. To me, the best actor in the whole thing was Andrew Szymanski, who plays a relatively minor role of this reporter whom Amy becomes involved with. I guess not as a youth, but later on. And I don't know if it was partly, again, the writing, but it just seemed to me that there was a subtlety in his performance that just was not there in many of the others. As Peter said, it's a very, very paint-by-numbers show. I kind of felt like if the show had been written and first done in 1920, it might have been thought of as a much better piece. But as it is, there was so much, on the nose writing in it, that it really was kind of embarrassing. Other people have compared it to something you might see in Branson, Missouri. And I've never seen one of those, but I think I know what they mean there. So I just thought, it was a missed opportunity because it is a fascinating life, as Peter said. Mm. It sure is. But the book and the lyrics were so clunky. I suppose the music itself was fine, but it's kind of hard to divorce it from the book and the lyrics, of course. I guess that's primarily what I have to say about Scandalous.
Oh dear, I'm going on Thursday.
Sorry. One kind of humorous thing. It had been reported and reviewed that Ed Watts, who plays he also has a double role, and in one of them he plays someone who's an actor in Amy's kind of religious pageants that she puts on, and it had been reported that he in Act Two that he is sort of half naked and that he displayed quite a spectacular body. And that certainly turned out to be very true, but I had to laugh because I was joking that in a way Ed Watts is sort of like the chandelier in Miss Saigon, because you can't leave after Act One because you know that this thing is something good is going to happen in Act Two, and I know several people who maybe half jokingly said that that's why they stayed.
Amy really did do those tableaus of biblical scenes. That was a big part of her attraction. She really was into show business. Ed Watts is a very good performer, and even if he kept his clothes on during that scene, you would certainly enjoy him because he has a marvelous voice and has a great leading man presence. I've seen him do Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, both at Paper Mill and at Music Theater of Wichita. He was in the Fantastics earlier this year too. So he's a wonderful working actor. And I wish him well, and I look forward to his getting into a better show.
So, Jan, you know, perhaps you'll be able to find a diamond in the rough there, as well as we've all seen shows side by side and come out with different opinions.
That's
so maybe
true.
You'll
absolutely
something else.
Sure,
that's true.
I'd much rather you have a good time than agree with me.
Have faith there, but
oh gosh,
Jan, you did get to see Giant at the Public. So why don't you tell us about Giant?
Giant is the new musical by Michael John Lacusa, who is maybe a little bit controversial because people some people really love his work and some people are a little mystified by it. I should, full disclosure, just say I'm often swept away by his music. I'm a big Michael John Laguza fan. And Giant is based on the Edna Ferber 1952 novel that was made a few years later, I think maybe 3 or 4 years later, into a big sprawling movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Rock Hudson. And it was the last performance of James Dean. And so most people probably know it because of the movie. It starts in the 1920s. It's the story of a man who owns a vast amount of land in Texas, and he goes to, I believe it's Virginia, to buy a horse. And while he's there, he meets this young woman and falls quickly in love with her, she with him. They marry and move back to his ranch. And this sort of upsets things because he was supposed to marry the girl in the ranch next door and combine their huge estates into this one big mega ranch. He was raised by an older sister, a much older sister, who had great hopes for him and his future and is not happy with this Easterner who has come back. It's really a story of the history of Texas from the 20s through the 50s. It deals with all kinds of subjects, the book, the movie, and the play. And I have not read the book, but the musical pretty much tracks the story that's told in the movie. And so it deals with oil and cattle and changing attitudes in the 20s between men and women, and attitudes towards the Mexicans who lived and worked in Texas during that period. I saw the musical was first done down at the Signature Theater in Virginia back in, I think, 2008, 2009. And I am such a big Michael John fan that I actually went down to see it. And at that point, it was 4 hours, a little over 4 hours. And now it's playing at the Public Theater. It's been trimmed to, I think, 3 hours and 15 minutes. And I actually miss those 45 minutes that are missing. I found this time the book, which was written by, I'm sort of vamping as I look it up.
Sybil Pearson.
One of, thank you. To be a little choppier here than it was in Virginia. They obviously didn't want to have a four-hour evening. Not a lot of people are going to do that unless they're going to see the Ring cycle. So they didn't want to do that, but they didn't want to lose the music. And so they sacrificed the book to the point that part of the story is that the children of this man and woman who marry, they have children and the children grow up, and the story actually switches to what happens with the children. And in this production, the son is played by Bobby Steggert, who gets very little to do, very little to sing. Father is played by Brian D'Arcy James. The main character's name is Jordan Benedict. He's called Bick by his friends. And Brian D'Arcy James plays him. And his wife, Leslie, is played by Kate Baldwin. Two very terrific and accomplished people. But I have to say that I liked the actors whose names I don't know, who weren't well known, who played the characters in Virginia better. They sort of better matched, in a way, the characters. Bick is supposed to be a big Texan. And Brian D'Arcy James is many things, but he's not a big guy. Mm. And I sort of missed that. The sister is played by Michelle Pock, and again in Virginia she was there were more colors to the character than I think Michelle Pock has been able to bring here. And I'm really curious. I think Peter's seen it. I'm not sure if Michael has what they think of it. I do think that the score is gorgeous, but I am biased.
I don't think you're biased. I don't think that counts as bias. But I would like to ask you, Jan, because I've been a long time Michael John Lacusa fan also. But I do think that with Queen of the Mist and with this show, I do think that he has his work has become noticeably more melodic.
Much more accessible.
Yeah, more accessible, more melodic. As I think I said maybe last week, he always had melody, of course, in his writing. But I think that the melodies tended to be shorter and not repeated as often and not as developed as much. My point in saying this is if there are those out there who feel that they don't especially like his early work and sort of quote unquote gave up on him before Queen of the Mist, I would really honestly recommend that you give both Queen of the Mist and Giant when it's hopefully recorded, if you can't get to see it live, a chance, because I really think that even if you did feel that way, you will no longer.
All right. Peter, what did you think about it?
Michael's music to me is fun to listen to in the theater, and it fits the mood very well. I tend not to listen to his CDs, but after all, these things are made for the theater and not for recordings. So recordings are wonderful, of course, and we're thrilled to have them. But nevertheless, I do find myself enjoying myself when I'm sitting there, and then when I get home and play the album, my mind wanders. Still, I hope this does get recorded. A lot of it is quite epic and sweeping and has that sound of the Old West and the New West, and so he really did a very good job as far as that's concerned. I was very taken with it in the first act. I lost a little patience with it in the second. It didn't strike me as compelling in the second. But I have to say, I think that's true of the movie, too. The first time I ever saw the movie was not until reasonably recently, by the way. It was just a picture I just never caught up with. A friend of mine had the DVD, and I was staying with him in Boston, and we watched the first part of it, and it got late, so we said, oh, we'll watch the next part tomorrow night, and we were going to a show in Providence, Rhode Island, and we couldn't wait to get back to see that second part, and it didn't live up to what the first part was, so I'm not surprised the musical doesn't either. When I saw Brian D'Arcy James in this show, I agree with you, Jan. I mean, it doesn't seem like, he's this big, burly Texan. And certainly not. And I guess what they were doing, I'm guessing, I have no idea. I'm guessing that they said, well, because Rock Hudson was that type, we're not going to get Ed Watts. We're going to get somebody who looks very different because we don't want to be compared to the movie. That's my guess on that. I thought the cast was terrific, and I especially liked Michelle Pock. And I was reminded of something when I saw Lolita, My Love, back in 1971. I think I've told this story, where at intermission, two guys came out of the Schubert Theater into the lobby, and one said to the other, well, there's no sense in staying because the only good thing about the show was Dorothy Loudon, and now she's dead. And the other guy said, well, maybe she'll come back in a flashback or a dream. And the guy said, wow, you think so? And they walked right back in the theater, hoping that Dorothy Loudon would come back. Dorothy Loudon didn't come back in Lolita, My Love, but Michelle Pock does come back in the second act of Giant, Thank the Lord, because she really is terrific in the role of the sister, the one that Mercedes McCambridge played so well in the movie. I'm glad I went. I wish it well. I don't know if there's a Broadway audience for this. I'm not quite certain of that. But nevertheless, Michael has done his work well, and so has Sybil Pearson, as best as they can with material that I think is flawed to begin with. So I consider this a noble effort.
On this is a movie that I've seen about 20 times.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, it's interesting. You're going to think I'm nuts, but I actually think in some ways that the musical is an improvement on the movie. I saw the whole thing for the first time on a big screen about 2 years ago, and I hated it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think to me it is so obvious. It's just so melodramatic and so obvious. And that I don't think that anyone could say that's a flaw of the musical, no matter what else one might say about it. So for what it's worth, yes, I thought it was an improvement on the film.
All right, so let's move forward here. Last week we talked about A Christmas Story. Michael had seen it, and Peter had seen bits and pieces of it in a previous incarnation in a group sales presentation. But Peter, you finally got to the theater to see the whole thing in its entirety. What did you think?
Oh, I love it. I really do. Longtime listeners here know that I saw the first act in Hershey, Pennsylvania. So this was the first time I saw the second act. There was a production in the second act you will be talking about for the production number for the second act you'll be talking about for the rest of your life. Something happens. I'm not going to give it away, but I'm telling you, you will see something that you won't expect to see, and you will not forget. Also, there's a wonderful joke at the end of the show that really made me laugh out loud. So for an extended period of time, because there's been a big issue over the fact that the younger brother in this show, Randy, is what they call a fussy eater. As George Carlin used to say, a fussy eater is also known as a pain in the ass, you know. And indeed, Randy is. But something happens at the end of the show dealing with this fussy eater issue that is so delightful and so hilarious. I'm laughing about it again, see?
That was a great moment. And I don't remember if it's in the movie. Anyone?
Yeah, I have no idea if it is. I don't remember it in the movie. I can't say that I do. It's not that I know the movie inside out, but I don't remember it in the movie. And I thought it was so clever. I love these Gene Shepard stories to begin with. I discovered them years and years and years and years ago, and I used to chortle for hours on end at them. And really, the weaving together, of course, mostly done by the movie, I'll grant you, 30-odd years ago, is very adept. And Joseph Robinette, who did the book, knew exactly what to take and what to leave out. So I think that his work is skillful. We talked about this before, but I'm hoping that business will warrant that they'll keep going and nobody will be concerned that Christmas has come and gone come January and they'll still want to see this show because it is so so good. But don't miss this second act number.
Can you say a little bit more about which, without giving it away, which one you mean? Because I think
it takes place at a speakeasy.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Something happens in that number that is spectacular.
So, Jan, do you concur here?
I liked it. Not as much as the guys did. A little bit of Christmas stuff goes a long way with me, Adam. But even a Scrooge like me had a good time. It's really well done, and I think the staging of it is just so terrific. And actually, Michael said last week that he talked about the kids, and the kids in this really are terrific. They're just wonderful actors and dancers, and they're just really good. And so I went with my sister, who is the exact opposite of me. She loves every Christmas show there is. I mean, so she was just in heaven with it. And it's a good time. And you saw lots of families there having a good time. It's worth it, and it's also worth it to talk about Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, have clearly a bright future ahead of them if they stick with this. They're sort of interesting because they've got all of the old Broadway technique and bones and so on, and yet these guys are young. I don't think they're 30 yet. And as we saw in Dogfight, which was their play this summer, their musical this summer, they can also bring in a more contemporary sound without violating the Broadway idiom. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what they do next.
I'm looking forward to it. So Before we wrap up our reviews of the week, Michael wanted to talk about Outgoing Tide, which is at 59 East 59. So, Michael, you have a few words to say about it?
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful play with Michael Learned, whom we all know and love from The Waltons, and Peter Strauss, whom we all know and love from several TV miniseries, and Ian Lithgow, who is John Lithgow's son. It's a three-character play, and it's about I don't believe they ever mentioned the name Alzheimer's, but it's about some kind of the Peter Strauss character is experiencing some kind of dementia, and the question is how this family, he and his wife and his son, are going to deal with that. And I just thought it was lovely, lovely writing by Bruce Graham, directed by Bud Martin at 59 East 59 Theaters. I was very moved by it. I thought Peter Strauss was especially phenomenal. It's a very theatrical performance. I suppose I could understand some people not liking it for that reason, but I thought it was perfect for the character, and I thought he did a brilliant job as all three of them did, and I highly, highly recommend it. I hope it has a further life somewhere. I don't know if it's a Broadway play, but you know, I hope it's done all over the regions, which it probably will be, because it's a great play with three characters. I highly, highly recommend it.
Oh, great. So other things to talk about this week, some buzz is happening from our friends out on the left coast. The new movie called Lincoln, which was directed by Steven Spielberg and written by Tony Kushner and Doris Kearns Goodwin, seems to have a lot of stage actors in it, Michael, doesn't it?
It has a lot. I wish I had the IMDb open in front of me. I couldn't even begin to tell you, but let's see. Michael Stuhlbarg is in it. Steven Spinella.
Hal Holbrook, James Spader.
Julie yes. White. Julie White's in it.
Yeah, Julie White.
And Esipatha Merkerson in a very small but very, very pivotal role, and I will not say another word about that.
So it is it's worth seeing, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing just to every 2 minutes. There's so many characters in it, so many great actors, and every 2 minutes some fabulous stage actor popped up, and I was like, "Oh my god." Christopher Evan Welch, who's been in many shows and was also had a great part in The Master, the film The Master with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix. So he seems to be doing very well with his screen career. You'd see it for the acting alone, but it's also very well written by Tony Kushner, who is one of the theater's greatest playwrights. If you're a theater lover, don't miss Lincoln.
Other things that happened in the news recently is the Amy Winehouse musical has sort of been canceled, I guess, due to rights issues. And while it wasn't going to be playing in the U.S. anytime soon, it seemed to be much anticipated. And so we'll have to see if that gets back on or not. Other things in the news, sad news to bring to you is that Marty Richards, who is a Broadway producer, has passed away at the age of 80.
When did that happen?
I was just this afternoon it was announced.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, so Peter, did you know Marty?
In fact, we did a sit-down at the Friars Club where I asked the questions and he gave the answers. That was a few years ago. He was quite nice, and there's no question that his devotion to Chicago is one of the reasons Chicago became not simply a stage show, but also the film. He really was intent on getting that property done, and Lord knows it didn't take just a couple of weeks for that to happen. So he was very devoted to it. I remember going first meeting him at the Backers audition on the 20th Century, which he was involved with his then wife, who predeceased him by quite some years, Mary Lee Johnson, and they believed so heartily in this Comden and Green musical, and I'll never forget being in the Swank penthouse, and it they were so apologetic because it was supposed to be, and imagine this, Betty and Adolph doing the show with Cy Coleman at the piano, and Betty was sick. So Willie Burke, who had a small role in the show, you know, but yeah, that was, and they were so embarrassed, you know, and everybody, they felt the pain so much of it that the rest of us really suddenly feeling, oh, come on, don't feel bad. No, no, it's all right. It's the play's the thing, you know, that type of thing. But so yeah, Marty was always good to me. So I'm sorry. And these days, I'm sorry to say 80 isn't even that old. So I wish you could have hung around a lot longer.
That's
So,
had he been ill?
Not that I had known. I hadn't heard any rumors to that effect, but I guess he was, yeah.
So. He had a very memorable moment at the Oscars. I certainly remember it when he accepted for Chicago. And as I recall, he was on stage with Rob Marshall, and I'm sure other people too. And he was just going on and on praising Rob Marshall to the skies about his brilliant work on the film. And it was a really, really sweet, wonderful moment.
So I've seen a bunch of online reports about it, and they have all these pictures of him. He looks so young.
Yeah.
He, you know, a young 80, if you will.
Yeah, he had a lot of energy, too, you know, which the best producers have.
I didn't know he was instrumental in founding Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, and also Meals on Wheels. So,
right, yes.
You know, he's broken the mold of the greedy Broadway producer
right.
there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think he's one. I think he's one of those people who I never heard a bad word said about him.
Yeah,
just kind of universally beloved.
Yeah. All right. So on that note, I think we'll wrap up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can also get This Week on Broadway through Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone or your smart device, like an Android device or a BlackBerry. And that way you can listen to us on the fly. We also are played on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. So if you have a chance, take a listen over there. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me are on that page there, as well as Jan this week. We have a link to Broadway and Me and her Facebook page and Twitter as well. So check us all out there. And if you want to get in touch with us, there's all sorts of ways to reach us through going to Broadway Radio. So anything coming up this week that we should mention before we go?
I will mention that I saw The Golden Land the other night. It's only running till the end of the week. It's a musical about immigrants, and it really will make you feel that you have to honor your father and grandmother. So your grandfather and grandmother, or great-grandfather and grandmother, depending on how old you are, for making the journey over here, because that certainly isn't an easy thing to do. I'm going to Sorry, which I haven't been to, so I'm going to the piano lesson. I'm going to Drood. I'm going to Boston to celebrate a birthday party. I'm going to Starting Here, Starting Now. So, yeah, things are happening.
You said The Golden Land?
Yeah.
Where is it playing?
At Brew College on 25th near Lexington. It's Zalman Milotek, who did it about 27 years ago, I think, something like that. It was a show that was simply a jukebox musical, in essence, though the jukebox would have had to have been on Second Avenue because it deals with all these Yiddish songs, or early American songs, really, and talking about the immigrant experience, about what it's like to come over here and not know a word of English, and fully expecting that this is the Golden Land, and slowly but surely finding out that there may be a little tarnish on that gold, but still, if you rub hard enough, you can get the tarnish off and you can make your dreams come true. So, beautifully done. Sandy Rosenberg is one of my favorite performers, is in it. She does a fabulous job. So, small, intimate, nice. And this was a show that when it opened 27 years ago, nobody thought a thing of it, and it ran 6 months in an off-Broadway setting, which is pretty good for an off-Broadway musical. And, you know, this one is just a limited edition. For those who collect Broadway musicals, musicals of the past. In April, they're going to be doing the Megilla of Itzik Manger, which is a 1968 musical, 68-69 season. So for those who want to catch up on a show they might have missed back then that did play Broadway and was around for a while, they'll be doing that too. So it's a nice organization they have down there at Baruch.
All right.
It's the National Jewish Theater, the Volksbühne Theater. They've merged, and they do nice stuff.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Michael, Jan, anything going on with you?
Well, just speaking of Broadway Cares, one of their biggest fundraising events is coming up, the Gypsy of the Year. Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS on Monday and Tuesday, December 3rd and 4th. So people want to be aware of that.
I'm going to be catching up this week. I'm going to be seeing Virginia Woolf and Scandalous. And I'm really looking forward to seeing Civil War Christmas, Paula Vogel's play.
Yeah, me too, Jan.
Yeah. So.
I'm hearing, I never actually check the grosses, but I'm sure that James does and can. I'm hearing that Virginia Woolf is not doing well.
Oh, really?
And I hope, I guess that's all relative. I mean, it can't be that costly to run, but talk about, again, universally beloved. I don't think there was a bad review. It just raves, but maybe, it's a combination of the fact that it was here not that long ago, and obviously it's not the most commercial property in the world. If you're avoiding seeing Virginia Woolf for any reason, please don't. Please see it. It's just incredible.
Yeah, Virginia Woolf played at just above $300,000 with a 61% audience. So it's in jeopardy there. That's pretty low numbers for a Broadway play.
Yeah.
The next line below it is, because it's alphabetical, it goes Virginia Woolf, then Wicked. Wicked is playing at $2.2 million at 97%.
So. Let me mention this, too, before we go. For people who have never seen a show at the Mark Hellinger Theater, which has been the Times Square Church for much too long a time now, I was passing by yesterday and I noticed that there's going to be a show called Come Home for Christmas, which I think is going to be a glorified concert. They're going to have 200 people on stage singing, I'm sure, Christmas carols and inspirational songs. But for those who have never been in the Hellinger, this might be the closest you ever get to seeing a show there. December 21st at 7, December 23rd at 10 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, 6 at night, free admission. How can you go wrong? I think I'm going to go and try to sit in H19, which was the seat I sat in for my first Broadway show, My Fair Lady, and come full circle. So, again, it ain't going to be a Broadway show, but it may be the closest thing we ever get to seeing something like that at the Mark Hellinger Theater.
Peter, that's great. Thank you for mentioning that. That's fantastic.
Oh, good.
Oh, that's great. All righty. So I guess we'll wrap up here. So on behalf of Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Jan Simpson, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Good night.
Still night. Drove with his last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable stars. This is my quest to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right. Without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest. One man, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable star.